May 16th, Business and Consumer Affairs Committee.
Clerk will note those members present. Representative Markham and somebody else asked to be excused. And when I recall who the somebody else is, I'll tell you. And I'm going to start today with House Bill 3280 on mental health insurance. And I'm going to call Ralph Crenshaw. Is it? No, it's Crenshaw? Crenshaw?
Crenshaw.
Excuse me, sir. Dr. Crenshaw.
My name, should I go ahead, sir?
Mm-hmm.
My name is Ralph Crenshaw. I'm a physician in Portland, Oregon. I am the former president of the Multnomah County Medical Society. I'm testifying in favor of this bill. I'd like to make 3 points briefly. One is that in getting adequate coverage for mental health services in an insurance situation is extremely difficult. For an individual or a union man to negotiate with an insurance company and decide what kind of benefits to be held that should be held by the policy, it's pretty easy to talk about pregnancy or broken arms or having pneumonia. However, in the negotiations, it's almost inconceivable for the individual to think that he would have mental illness or his relatives might have mental illness. The facts are that everybody in the United States has a risk of mental illness, and 1 in 10 are hospitalized at some time in the course of their lives. It is a high incidence, but again, it's very hard to negotiate about. Next point I'd like to make about this bill is that it actually shouldn't cost a great deal more, because a lot of hospitalization for mental illness now is occurring under disguised, or perhaps you might call, corrupt circumstances. That is, people with mental illnesses are being admitted to general hospitals, but for medical diagnosis. That is, they'd be admitted for a spastic colon rather than that they were having a severe depressive reaction. They would be admitted for other kinds of medical diagnoses, even though the physician can be well aware that about 45% of his patients coming to him have some kind of emotional difficulty. Therefore, the patients are being hospitalized, but under less than straight circumstances. And then, as a final point in this matter, I'd like to make the point that this is one of the few bills that the state can pass and not cost money for the state. The state has a long history of being in the mental health business, and has been in the most expensive part of the mental health business, has been in the hospitalization end of mental health, and hospitalizes a large number of people throughout the state who could be carrying full mental health coverage in their in health insurance. In the event that they are carrying any form of mental health insurance at this time, Damish Hospital or the state hospital can deduct this money from the cost the state has to put out to hospitalize people. Therefore, in passing this bill, you would be subsidizing our present mental health services in the state to a sizable degree. I don't know precisely how much, but it would be possible to help out in this way. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Crenshaw, or Dr. Crenshaw. Questions for the doctor?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is John Ewelling with the Oregon Medical Association. I'd like to just very briefly add to what Dr. Crenshaw has said and address myself to the bill specifically. If you look at the bill, House Bill 3280, the Oregon Medical Association strongly supports this piece of legislation. It does 2 things. It asks that inpatient treatment, that is hospital treatment, be provided up to 120 days in any calendar year for mental health coverage. And I might add that the largest health insurance company in the state is presently offering this policy, that is 120 days of mental health coverage. There are many health insurance companies that are not providing any mental health coverage at all. And in between the very best, that is the largest that's offering 120-day coverage, and those who are offering none, there are other companies that are offering coverage, but it's very limited, where you might have a major medical policy up to $250,000. The mental health coverage policy might only go to $2,500 or $5,000 or perhaps $10,000. And that is not for 1 year, but that is for the lifetime of the contract. So you can very quickly use up your mental health coverage. Essentially, what we want to try to do is to bring mental health coverage into the mainstream of medicine. It has not been in the mainstream of medicine, as Dr. Crawshaw has indicated. It's been treated by people who perhaps should not be treating mental health illness. The concept of the outpatient care, which is point number two, as you can see, the language of the legislation before you would amend that. Instead of being 50% rate, it would be raised to an 80% rate to a maximum of $800, which means that for outpatient care, a patient could either see a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and let's say they were charging $50 an hour, they would be able to see that psychiatrist for 20 outpatient visits, which both the psychiatrist and the psychologist felt would be appropriate and adequate coverage. So we feel that we have before you a piece of legislation that the insurance industry can live with. There will be some insurance companies who will oppose us because they impose all mandated coverage, but there will be insurance companies who will not be present to testify against this bill because they feel they can live with this piece of legislation. And finally, we feel it's going to be an excellent bill for those patients out there who are presently finding it very difficult to have mental health coverage. So if the committee has any questions, either myself or Dr. Crawshaw would be more than happy to answer, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chairman. Questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Joe Trelevin.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Joe Trelevin, Assistant Administrator of the Mental Health Division. I want to speak in favor of this bill. We at the Mental Health Division agree with the testimony that has been already presented, and I will not repeat that. We do feel that it will have a significant advantage in allowing private care and early care to Oregonians and ultimately reduce the burden on the state-financed and state-operated services. So we strongly endorse this. Be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. M.R. Arbuckle.
Chairman, I'm Dick Arbuckle, Assistant Manager, Health and Social Service Section, Public Welfare Division, Department of Human Resources. With me is Don Schlickman, Medical Fiscal Supervisor, Health and Social Service Section. Unlike the previous witnesses, we're not here to testify either for or against the bill, but to report to the committee the results of our evaluation of the bill in terms of its impact on the state's Title 19 Medical Assistance Program. Here again, like the earlier witnesses, we can be very brief. There is a system in place, has been for years, as a result of both federal and state requirements, that assures insurance resources are used prior to use of public funds being paid through Title 19 medical assistance. In that respect, then, this bill would have no impact in terms of what the Welfare Division is already doing. We already have a system in place to make sure that health insurance resources are used before public funds are used through Title 19 medical assistance. We expect that this bill would have a fiscal impact in terms of a reduction in the amount of Title 19 medical assistance payment during a biennium, but we also anticipate that it would be very minimal We're unable to precisely define the fiscal impact because we don't know yet the extent of liability or the extent of utilization. I guess, Mr. Chairman, what I'm saying is we expect that this bill, if it becomes law, would lead into a slight reduction in Title 19 medical assistance payments.
Thank you.
That completes my comments.
All right. Questions? Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to appear on House Bill 3280? Not that concludes the hearing on the bill. Senate Bill 19 calls John Darling first, please.
That's the thing I wanted to ask, but I was hoping an insurance office.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Darling. I work for Senator Hannon as a legislative assistant. I wonder if I might have Mr. Howick come up here and sit with me to explain the intent of this bill. He helped draw it up. I'm just merely here to say that Senator Hannon was in on the drafting of this, and he does support it. It affects three ambulance services in Jackson County, which operate on a nonprofit subscription basis, and which are operating in relatively remote areas, Eagle Point, Butte Falls, and Prospect, and which are not intended to be in competition with regular profit-making ambulance services.
Mr. Howard?
Mr. Chairman, the whole point of this bill is to relieve these ambulance services of the expense of the $50,000 surety bond with the insurance commissioner. And the bill was amended from its original language into the form in which you now see it at our request. We felt that this was the chief objective of the proponents was to be relieved of this expense. And the safeguard or the limit on it is that the service has to have at least 75% of its assets directly invested in the facilities that it uses to provide this health care. We feel in those situations that a bond is probably of no real need, because they have the equipment, the facilities to provide the service, and the bond wouldn't add that much to the security to the public.
Thank you, Mr. Howard. Yeah.
The bill summary, you notice, has an error in that it refers to the capitalization requirements, and that's not correct.
That's an error.
Yes. Yeah. All
right. Thank you. Questions for either Mr. Howard or Mr. Darling? Will they make their exit? Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Don Miles?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Don Miles, the manager of the Eagle Point Rescue and Ambulance Corporation, also a representative for Butte Falls Ambulance and Prospect Ambulance. Speaking for this bill, all of the organizations down there that we're talking about are in kind of a remote area. It's pretty hard to even keep funds to operate, much less pay a $2,500 fee per year for a surety bond of this nature. Many of the groups depend on probably that much money as their a large percentage of their money for operating. Those $25, $100 would represent quite a lot of operating funds to any of these three organizations. I don't feel that I need to go into any more of the testimony as they already covered it, but we are much in favor, and I just wanted you to know that I'm speaking for the three organizations.
Thank you, Mr. Miles.
Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Miles? Representative Klein?
Well, by my district, but thanks for coming up.
Close by, I just thought you
got I'm sure Tiff is here, but he wouldn't get it. Thank you, Tiff.
Okay. Margaret Mitchell?
Interesting, we have all these bills from that part of the state. That's fine.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Margaret Mitchell. I'm a registered nurse. I come from the Southern Oregon area. I would like to say that I am in support of this bill. I've been involved in emergency services both at a state level and at a local level since their inception a number of years ago, and I have also been involved in the writing of preparation of grants and application for equipment and so on for ambulance services. One thing that I would like to bring out, that even though the Volunteer Ambulance Association are a non-fee-making business, they are subject to the same costs of operation, the same match funds for federal grants, the same allotment of equipment as are the profit-making ambulance services. On top of that, they provide service to the community. In the case of Eagle Point, they make approximately 60 runs per month in the Eagle Point area. They serve a 600 square mile area. They provide free service to all of the senior citizens in that 600 square mile area. They also provide free service to the school children in the entire District 9 area. That has amounted so far to 550 free runs for the children in that area. They are further penalized by having to post $2,500 a year amount for this $50,000 bond. I believe that even though I speak for the Eagle Point area, it is representative of all volunteer agencies in the state, that they should not be further penalized by being required to post this bond amount.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. Questions? Thank you very much. Thank you both for coming up today. Is there anyone else wishing to appear on Senate Bill 19? Yes, sir.
Colonel Herb Steiner, and I'm representing the Volunteer Ambulance Association of Oregon. I am their treasurer, and we had a meeting last Saturday at Pendleton, Oregon. At that meeting, we discussed this bill, and we didn't quite understand it, so they left it up to me when I come back here to see what I thought of it. Listening to it, we're all for it. The volunteers are having a hard enough time the way it is to make a living with their ambulance. We do most of our work free of charge. We get donations. We can't go out here and charge for our work because we are a volunteer organizations. So we have to hold our expenses down as much as we possibly can, and we are slowly being run out of business by different insurances and by different bonds and so on that we have to carry. We are going to ask for different legislation pretty soon, maybe not this year because we are not ready for it, but by next year we will be coming in with some bills to relieve. We hope we can relieve the Volunteer Ambulance Association. I'm sure this is a start right here. So I hope that you gentlemen will seriously consider putting this bill through for us because it will help us greatly. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Questions for Mr. Steiner?
Chairman, I'd like to...
Yes, Representative Markham.
Mr. Steiner, how... Matter of information. How many organizations are that you're treasurer of statewide?
There is about 124 ambulance associations in Oregon, and I would say about, as near as I can tell you now, just slightly over 70 volunteers.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Is there anyone else wishing to appear on Senate Bill 19? If not, that concludes the hearing. House Bill 3282, Mr. Rawls. Mr. Rawls here today.
3282.
Mr. Howitt?
32 what? 82. 82. 82.
82.
82.
Right behind you, Sonny.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know how we're signed up on this bill as proponents or opponents, but
pick a side.
Why don't you pick a side and see how you
well,
come down?
Well, I think
check.
That the bill...
You're signed up on neither side.
Okay,
simply left blank.
Fine. We think it's a questionable policy to give the commissioner the authority to extend insurance policy grace periods. As far as we know, the emergency conditions that are described in subsection 4 of section 2 have never created a problem that has come to our attention. And we suspect that there is some provision in common law that when natural disasters prevent insurance premiums from reaching an insurance company, that the policyholder is protected. I can't quite understand why this legislation is necessary, and I can foresee some situations where it would put the insurance commissioner in a somewhat untenable position where there are labor disputes between agents and companies to extend the grace periods. We would just prefer that this not pass.
All right, thank you, Mr. Howard. Questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else wanting to appear on the bill, House Bill 3282? We have someone going right now, Representative Cairns, to see if Representative Lindquist or any of the other named individuals want to testify. I don't see you.
There are two of them who don't want.
Representative Cairns, would you like to comment on this, or Representative Vian?
I'll wait for Mr. Lindquist to appear.
The request, the insurance workers, local number 100, AFL-CIO.
Request that to come out.
All right. Well, I'll close the hearing on this. Should Representative Lindquist or any of the other proponents decide they'd like to testify on behalf of the measure, we'll allow them to do that by simply reopening the hearing. That concludes the hearing on that bill.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 63. Mr. Howard, again, you're signed up, or Mr. Rawls is signed up. There he is. Mr. Rawls, Senate Bill 63.
Hey, Chairman, I'm sorry I was up in another...
That's all right. There wasn't any proponents or opponents on the last measure.
Okay. The Senate Bill 63, Chairman, makes changes in the existing property and casualty insurance guarantee law. This legislation, in effect, is in the majority of states at the present time, mandates that insurance companies doing business in the states guarantee the payment of all losses that should have been paid by an insurance company which has gone bankrupt. The present statute requires the losses be paid with an exclusion of $100, thereby requiring the policyholder of the bankrupt company to absorb the loss up to $100. In addition, there is no provision in the present statute for payment by the guarantee association of the unearned premium, thus causing the policyholder to lose whatever unused premium he has paid to the bankrupt company.
Mm-hmm.
Senate Bill 63, as originally requested by the insurance division, required the guarantee association to pay the unearned premiums and losses to no deductible. Under Senate amendments, the guarantee association has a $50 deductible on the losses and return premium. Remember, insurers have an offset against the premium tax or corporate tax due to the state of Oregon. The amendments also restore the deductible to the extent of $50. I think
questions, yeah. Representative Cairns.
Mm-hmm. What is the standard in your states? You referenced the national picture, but what is the average of the states as far as deductible and the treatment of the unearned premium? Is that a state-by-state case?
State-by-state. The states, there have been, we've had meetings on a national basis with the companies. This has been a problem that transcends all states, especially in the past 3 or 4 years where a number of companies have gone under. And the trend has been for the states to do away with deductibles, several different reasons. Also then to include a offset to premium tax or corporate tax for those domestic companies who are not taxed on a premium basis. And also to give those companies that are still doing business quick access to the assets that are left in the bankrupt company. So it's been kind of a balancing of that nature. Our bill is to include the unearned premium and the do away at the deductible is pretty much in keeping with the trend that hopefully will be equal across the country with every state when they pass all the bills. There will be differences, though. Each state has its own ideas on this, but this is a national trend.
Okay, of the 50 states, do the majority have zero deductible and a statement and a policy towards favorable to the premium payer, that is the insured, regarding the unearned premium? Is it better than 50-50, do you know?
I really couldn't honestly.
But you say that's the way the trend is going.
That's what the agreement through the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, we've come to that agreement. We propose to make that those changes. And many of the states are in session right now, and the laws are being changed, so I wouldn't really have an idea on that.
How difficult would it be to get some kind of a global picture, not particularly discreet, but some kind of a more trend as far as, something to indicate trend?
Well, as I say, that the NAIC has gone on record to support this type of bill we have here. I think that we would find that the majority of states are still in session, so the commissioners report back. They wouldn't know until the session's over, for sure.
Do you recall what Senate Bill 63 passed the Senate by?
Numbers and...
I
don't know if there was any opposition. One no.
One no at the $50 level and...
Another question.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative
Shaw. Yeah, Mr. Rawls, when you say a tax offset, are you talking about a direct credit?
Yes, it would be a direct, if they had to pay $10,000 in premium taxes and they had paid out $1,000, it would be $1,000.
Dollar for dollar. Thank you.
Say again, sorry, Mr.
Go ahead.
Chairman, yes. could you give me that again in small words so I can see what's happening?
All right, for every dollar insurance that's purchased in the state of Oregon, $2.75 or almost $3, or 3 cents, it goes to premium tax.
Okay.
And comes to the state. Now, if the company were assessed $10,000, we'll say, as their premium tax for the amount of business they wrote, and they had a subsequent loss of $1,000 because of the guarantee, they would deduct the $1,000 off the $10,000 and only pay $9,000.
Where did that $1,000 go to?
Well, it would have been already paid out by them into the guarantee fund to take care of the losses that were being paid for by the...
I see. So in other words, the guarantee, the Guarantee Association is made up of all of the insurers in the state, doing business in the state. In other words, who are sovereign, who underwrite that loss. Is that right?
They pay the loss out, and then when they pay it out, then they can deduct, they deduct it off. So I guess really, honestly, the ultimate payer is like everything, is the people of the state of Oregon.
Sure. Okay, I understand how that works.
Okay. Further questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go ahead, Representative Shaw.
Well, just a statement. what's the amount of dollars? No, it is a question. What's the amount of dollars that the insurance companies pay into the general fund over and above what is used up to handle their own affairs in the state, the audits and so on? Aren't they a major contributor?
Premium tax is, Mr. Hollett, maybe should come up here. The last estimate we had was about $42 million for biennium. I don't know what our estimate was for the next biennium.
About $47 million for the next biennium, and the insurance division's budget is around $3 million.
Now that's premium tax, though, but there's
fees of another $2 million or so.
Thank you,
Mr. Andrew Cairns.
Yes. What would your response be to an amendment to Senate Bill 63 downward in the deductible portion, down to zero or something between 50 and zero?
Well, my, quite frankly, Mr. Chairman, I favor a zero. I think that if we're going to have a guarantee fund, and we do have one, and whether we want to argue the pros and cons of that, I think that to apply a deductible very much flies in the face of the philosophy of a guarantee fund, and certainly because of the person who, innocent party who is the insured, is end up has to pay an unearned premium and so forth. By the way, I might point out too, this bill is one which could never be activated possibly if we do our job. Mr. Howard hates to have me say this, but if we do our job in the insurance division and police the companies properly and keep out those companies who may be financially insolvent, then this is something that would never come into fruition, but I just feel it's the best interest of the public that if we do have one, we don't have any deductible law. Now, there's arguments on the other side, and I appreciate that, but that's my feeling.
Another question, between spreading the result of bankruptcy among everybody as a self-insured, as a self-insurance pool, one, first to those members of the Guarantee Association, and two, the people of Oregon through the loss of their corporate tax offset, or particularizing that loss to the policyholder in penalty for earned premium and seems to me zero is a heck of a lot better than 50 when it comes if we're talking about a guarantee association among insurance companies. And we ought to extend the idea of risk spreading all the way to its ultimate conclusion, down to zero.
I very much agree. You put it just that way, it's much easier on the total population than it would be on one person. So.
Further questions?
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Mr. Tom Bassinet.
Mr. Chairman and gentlemen of the committee, I'm Tom Bassinet. I'm with Oregon Mutual Insurance Company, and I have two statements. One, I hope they are both being passed out at this particular time. I say I have two statements. One was made to the Senate, and the other one is being made here. And I'll refer first to the one being made here because it gives some foundation to the statement made in the Senate. So I'll wait momentarily, if I might, for the... But you do have already before you the real flux of the question. The $50 deductible is the main issue at point. While that's being passed out, I might emphasize one thing, however, on the tax deduction, is that that's based on a 5-year basis.
20% per year. So in other words, the insurance industry is asked to pay on our tax rebate without any interest or any other proceeds coming back from that money that we've already spent. And interpolating a little bit, well, let's get into the statement. Okay. Under our current law, any claim against the Guarantee Association has an applicable $100 deductible, and there is no return of unearned premiums. This bill allows a computation of the unearned premium and that which is in excess of $50 refunded by the Guarantee Association. It also reduces the $100 deductible to $50 per claim. As explained in my statement of April 1st, 1977, presented to the members of the Consumer and Business Affairs Committee of the Senate, we, most of the insurance industry represented by lobbyists, have reversed our position in opposition to the bill to one allowing the return of unearned premium subject to a $50 deductible. I would point out to you that one of the major beneficiaries of the return premiums is premium finance companies. I attach a copy of one of the premium finance agreements. You will note that they are charging 22.25% interest on that loan. Now, to guarantee this type of business, that another regulated industry will have to make the guarantee of the payment of this note at 21.25% interest doesn't really make a great deal of sense. In checking the National Association of Independent Insurers, Jim Falstich, the ex-insurance commissioner of the state of Oregon, I find that about half of the states that have a guarantee association allows the return of unearned premiums. And about half of the states, not necessarily the same states that allow the return of unearned premiums, also have a $100 deductible for any claim presented against the association, which would include the return of unearned premiums if that state allows for that legitimate claim against the guarantee association. I would call your attention to page 9 of the bill, lines 4 through 7, which states in effect that the association would be obligated to pay any claim that would have been paid by the insolvent insurer that has arisen or that does arise within 30 days after the determination of insolvency. In other words, the agent does not have to replace the insurance policy for 30 days after the determination of insolvency, as the association itself provides this grace period without any premiums being paid to the association. Under these circumstances, we feel that the insurance industry is going far beyond the rest of the industries of Oregon in providing protection to the insuring public. The insurance industry appears to be recuperating from the worst threat in its 200 years of existence. We are now happy that the insurance commissioner's office has had two additional examiners provided by this legislative body in order to check the financial ability of each of the over 1,000 insurers of the state of Oregon so that we will not have to pay anything on behalf of insolvent insurers. Under these circumstances, we recommend passage of Senate Bill 63 as it was sent to you from the Senate. Thank you. I'd like now to refer to my statement of April 1, if I might, Mr. Chairman, and read it into the record here. Members of the committee, as you will recall, I originally opposed this bill, and it is still not to the industry's liking. One of the reasons is that most of the alert people of the insurance industry are aware that companies are in financial distress. Agents continue to sell the policies and allow them to be continued to be renewed and are now asking the well-managed portion of the industry to pay the bill. I submit there is no way that we can insure people against all the risks of life or against some of the financial pitfalls that face them. Most of the companies that have failed financially were those companies selling the high-risk auto drivers. In two of the high-risk carriers located in Salem, 50% of the company's policyholders pay the premium on a basis of 3 months, and the remainder paid on a monthly basis. Another carrier said that 10% of their policyholders paid on a 3-month basis and 90% on a 1-month basis. If this bill is enacted, it would mean the policyholders had 5 days left on the policy would receive a pro rata return of the premium equal to 5 days. This seems to bring
an administrative headache to the guarantee association that is now manned by a secretary and a part-time manager. Undoubtedly, they would have to employ more personnel to calculate the unearned premiums and to fill out the paperwork that is necessary to return the small premium dollar. We are the only industry that I'm aware of that is acting as its brother's keeper. The Guarantee Association has paid $750,000 of our policyholders' money on behalf of the insurance companies that were financially insolvent. There have been paid 944 claims paid by the Guarantee Association. If the $100 deductible had not been in the law, this would have meant the industry would have had to pay $94,000 additional of our policyholders' money to underwrite the bad practices of other people. Since most of the insurance lobby represents companies that are involved in the American agency system, that is, utilizing the independent insurance agents, and since they feel strongly that the return of unearned premium should be part of this law, we offer as a compromise by allowing the return of premium, but still feel strongly the $100 deductible should be retained for each claim against the Guarantee Association. This would still provide that if the person making the claim against the Guarantee Association had suffered a major loss of anything above the deductible, that would be reimbursed to them. Therefore, if a major insurance company did go broke and there was substantial return of premium due, it could be taken care of by protecting the agent as well as the policyholder. Other than this, we agree with the proposed amendment submitted by the insurance commissioner. I think that's basically it. Now,
additional remarks?
No, other than the fact that the good insurance companies that have had to pay into the Guarantee and Association on the basis of an assessment are also innocent people. Our policyholders have been innocent of the past. Now we're shifting it to the rest of the taxpayers of the state of Oregon through the tax offset. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cairns.
Can you go through, take me step by step, Mr. Bessonette, very roughly through the your statement in the fourth, fifth, sixth paragraphs of your statement to this committee regarding major beneficiaries, return of premiums, premium finance companies, and how that works.
What's a premium finance company? Okay. Two, how does the zero deductible or $50 deductible and the unearned premium return put money back in a premium finance company? Okay.
Basically, a premium finance company are utilized by some agents, and they accept a down payment from the insured themselves. The agent does. Mm-hmm. He then finances the rest of the premium, and so it's paid direct. The premium is then paid directly to the insurance company. The insured then pays off the premium finance company just like a regular finance company on a monthly basis. And that premium finance company has no risk whatsoever, because if the policy is canceled, the return of premium comes back from the insurance company, and they receive their proportionate share of that. Now, if the insurance company goes broke, there is no way that they can receive back any money other than going to the Guarantee Association. There is no restrictions made on return of premium being to an individual under our current proposed bill, 63. So therefore, anyone that has a return premium obligation would be entitled to be the beneficiary under the Guarantee Association. And in other states, I can't say the state of Oregon, but in other states, they have been the prime beneficiary of many of the return premium proceeds.
But they're holder in due course, aren't they? They put the money out, didn't they?
Yes, but their risk is very nominal. And they're receiving 21% interest.
I don't think I understand how it works.
You do or don't?
I do, yes. Well, I understand exactly what's...
Chairman?
Yes.
Representative Killings.
I'd like to see that a bit more, Tom. And I'm curious, are these premium finance companies
normal finance companies that are doing this as an additional service, or are there special, is this a special entity?
I'm really not able to answer that question, Representative Achilles. I'm sorry.
Let me put it a different way. Just looking for more background knowledge. Do banks get involved in financing premiums? Is there any competition? Why is somebody kind of getting away with 21% if there's no competition, I guess is what I'm looking for.
A bank would become a claimant. I hadn't thought about that until now. If they had advanced the premium on a car contract, and that insurance company went broke, the bank would be entitled to a return of that premium. They advance the premium for material damage as a rule only, however, collision insurance, because that's what they're carrying their paper on. I think most of the, what we call premium finance companies, are geared specifically for that purpose. They may be a subsidiary of another loan company, but they're geared specifically for return of premium, I mean for the insuring of the payment of the premium to the insurance company. The agent likes it because they have immediate cash flow.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Representative
Tell me, how many insurance companies gone bankrupt in the past year, 2 years, that
the Guarantee Association
is in Oregon?
The Guarantee Association is activated on 5, as I recall. I think you can look at the insurance commissioner or his staff and see if I'm accurate on that. 4 substandard carriers and 1 that is not a substandard carrier.
Hmm. Does that strike you as an unusually large number, or is that an unusually small number, or how do you think we're faring?
I can only compare Oregon against Oregon. And I haven't any idea. I do know that we, the industry, have went before the Ways and Means Committee and asked for and begged for and were successful in securing 2 additional examiners so that the insurance commissioner's staff could adequately or more adequately check the financial condition of companies not only that are in Oregon but that are making application to come into Oregon and sell to the Oregon consumer, because we're concerned about them.
It's 2 additional out of how many?
Makes a total of 13, as I recall. I believe they had 11. Again, you should look over my shoulder and see what the commissioners, whether
so
they're nodding in agreement.
Nodded no, so I assume that no nod is in the affirmative.
Misdirecting my questions here, but thanks, Tom. Appreciate
you're welcome. You're welcome.
Further questions for Mr. Bessonet?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cairns.
Same question that I gave the commissioner, and I know part of your answer because you've given us the material you gave to the Senate, but really, what's wrong with zero? I mean, if it's a question of the insured getting stiffed versus everybody sharing a risk pool, why stiff the insured who was dealing with a company he believed had every right to operate in the state of Oregon and felt to be solvent and would stand back of his policy, and then it turns out that what we're really going to do is stiff him for $50. We used to stiff him for $100, so 50 is obviously less than, you know, it's better, but what's wrong with zero if we're spreading $94,000 over, you know, how many insured?
I'd like to not leave the impression we're talking about $94,000. We're talking about one heck of a lot more than that when we can include the unearned premium. One insurance company alone was $507,000 of unearned premiums. Now, however, some of those...
That's a big stiffing.
Yeah. Some of those, however, would have been recovered had the agents not replaced that insurance policy for 30 days, because the Guarantee Association would have continued that insurance contract for 30 days after it was declared insolvent. So some agents reacted too quickly without knowledge of the law and placed insurance elsewhere, and was actually, they paid the premium themselves maybe. So, I mean, they shorted themselves by not having knowledge of the law. As far as the $100 deductible to the zero deductible, it's a policy decision. I personally would much prefer for a change to go to the federal government and allow the federal government to do this total thing with all 50 states being uniform so that we wouldn't have the battle. If we don't get a zero this time, maybe next time they'll come back trying to get zero. I just have a little bit of adversity towards this concept that I'm my total brother's keeper in everything that he does. Some of these people that have made claim on under the Guarantee Association are in their third company that has gone broke. Now, there's something wrong with that concept of placing this individual in three different companies that are reasonably shaky to start with. So I'm begging the answer, I guess, in one respect, because philosophically, I don't buy it.
Doesn't it say more about the agent that does the insured, though? That speaks a heck of a lot more to the agent that does the insured.
That's true.
It certainly does. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Achilles and Representative Klein. Representative Klein.
Tom, I think that this is the bill that we talk on, and I guess I ask you to look into the idea instead of doing the 30-day and cut them off with the deductible thing, if it wouldn't really cost you guys less to simply go with the insurance until the end of the paid premium period. It seems at the time we thought that might be the case, and I was wondering if you'd checked it out and
I have not had the opportunity to check with some of the other industry, but in my own company's viewpoint, they would prefer to have the 30-day cutoff because some of the policies, as we talked about, might run for a year, and they would not want the Guarantee Association writing that policy for a year because there's a lot of service work, change of cars, endorsements, etc., that must go on the policy. And the headache then for the Guarantee Association, they would in fact become an insurance company. So 30 days is plenty long enough.
That speaks to the headaches and the policy decisions from your company's viewpoint, which leaves the question of costs and equity unanswered.
There has to be a cutoff date. I mean, 31 days would cost no more than 30 days, 45 days, very little more, but 6 months, there gets to be a time in there where you just cannot extend beyond a certain period. And so far, the legislature says 30 days is it. We'll accept that.
Another question. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Scott O'Farrell.
Just my stuff has been passed out. For the record, my name is Scotty Ferris. I represent the Independent Insurance Agents of Oregon. We support in Gross Senate Bill 63. We do, however, offer an amendment to it, and this is to the deductible, which we've been discussing previously. We would like to see the deductible changed so that it is zero deductible. As the bill was originally introduced by the insurance commissioner, as you have just learned, it was a zero-based deductible. Through the efforts of one of the insurance companies, and here Mr. Bessonet and I disagree a little because my poll doesn't show the same results that his does, but how the insurance companies themselves feel about it, I think, is immaterial to the philosophical part of the question. The agents believe that this money should be refunded in full to the insured who bought the insurance in good faith. In fact, they feel strongly enough about this that many of them have dipped into their own pockets to return this to the insured. You can, I'm sure, appreciate the effect on the public when somebody who struggled to get enough money to pay for his insurance finds that the company is insolvent and he is unable to get his money returned in full. One of the representatives of one of the insurance companies, incidentally, who is in the lobby regularly, told me that one of their officers was an officer in the Guarantee Association and the phone literally jumped off the hook when the insurance companies went broke and these people were unable to get their unearned premiums returned. argument has been made that some of these unearned premiums are small and it would cost more administratively to return them than they are worth. This was an argument that was made in the Senate. That may be true if you are not the person on the receiving end. A return of $20 or even less may seem small to some people, but to a good many more people it is substantial. In addition, it would seem administratively that, and going back again for the example of the officer who received all the phone calls, it would seem administratively it might cost as much to do all the answering of the phone and writing letters as it would to return the money in full. A return of premium in full would certainly leave a much better feeling as far as the public is concerned with respect to having been had, so to speak. Oregon has long encouraged the acquisition of insurance by all drivers. Now, a statement was just made that agents sometimes place it with companies that go broke. The only thing that the agent has to base his judgment on which company to place insurance with is the list given by the insurance commissioner's office. Now, the insurance commissioner's office may have a feeling that an insurance company is not really in good shape, but obviously they can't go around talking about it or they're going to get sued for libel or slander. So what they do is start an audit of that company that they are a little bit skeptical of. And as you know, it takes a long time to complete that audit. And in the meanwhile, the only thing the agent has to go by is the published list of what is a licensed business insurance company doing business in Oregon. As you can appreciate from previous testimony, which you have heard here, it has not been easy to place insurance in the last couple years. If, as it used to be, that you could take your pick of several good line companies, that would be one thing, but we have people coming in whom you simply have a difficult time placing. The agent can't say, yes, I'll put you with the best company here or that. He can't place it, so he has to call the substandard companies to place it. Obviously, when you do this, and it gets difficult, but when you do this, the risk is involved in the company going broke, but that isn't anything that can be helped, and it isn't anything that I feel the agent should be blamed for. I think as a matter of public policy, Oregon has strongly encouraged acquisition of insurance by everybody. We feel strongly enough about it that there are several bills in the legislature this time to make it compulsory. If we are going to do that, if we are going to encourage that everybody have insurance, then I think that we should also realize that difficult as it is to get now, it's going to sometimes be placed where I'm sure even the agent himself would rather not place it. But the fellow has to have insurance. Going a step further, if he has to have it, then it seems to me that he has a right, if the company goes broke, it seems to me he has a right to expect the entire return of his unused premium, or unearned premium, if you will, and not be left holding the bag, so to speak. For that reason, we would like to see the deductible reduced to a zero deductible.
Thank you, Scotty. Questions for Scotty? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else wishing to appear on Senate Bill 63?
Chairman? Mr. Rawls isn't here, but could I pursue the line of questioning that's developing?
Sure you can, Mr. Howard.
Mr. Howard?
Sure. He'd be more than pleased to answer.
I can.
Not directly germane to the bill, Mr. Howard, but trying to get a feel for the process of approving insurance companies. And I can appreciate the practical problems of somebody wants to come in and sell insurance, you approve them. Could you describe the process for me very briefly as to how you go about accepting a new insurance firm?
Well, yes, the basic thing we rely on is the financial statement that the company has filed with its home state commissioner at the last hearing. And then, of course, we check that out for conformity with Oregon law. We try to evaluate the company's strengths and weaknesses and basically, our law requires $500,000 of capital and surplus, but it would be a rare company with less than $1 million that we would admit. We examined the last examination report that was made on that company, and if there are any red flags in that, we follow up on that. We may, our chief examiner is in touch with chief examiners of other states. He has contacts, you know, throughout the insurance world, and if there are any suspicious signs from any of these things, examination reports, financial statements, he probably will call up his contacts among the insurance examiners. And, you know, we just look for every little shred of evidence we can. We start with the...
If you find some evidence, then...
If we find that a company is too risky to be of benefit to the citizens of Oregon, then we try to find a legal hat rack to deny their application on.
Is it hard to find that, or is it reasonably easy to find it?
Well... it comes down to a question of whether you get challenged or not, and this is one area where we very seldom get challenged on. If you try to revoke a certificate of a company that's already doing business here, you've got a fight on your hands. But as a practical matter, companies don't too often make a very strong challenge to your denial of their certificate of authority, and we have denied quite a few of them. Yeah, I would have liked to have answered one of the earlier questions. I think we've had fewer insolvencies in our guarantee fund because a number of recent years insolvencies have been companies that we had turned down here. Sometimes they become insolvent while their application is pending with you.
Fortuitous.
That's fairly good evidence.
So by and large, you're satisfied that obviously you are, but...
it's a balancing. You never can be 100% certain. If you denied every company, you'd be sure you wouldn't be admitting any insolvent ones. But you know, we try to get the companies in that are going to do a job for the public, but you never can be absolutely certain that conditions won't change in the company or that they aren't hoodwinking you. We have one company here that is now in the hands of the Guarantee Association, the Medallion Insurance Group out of Missouri, that, you know, we had bad feelings about that organization for 6 or 7 years, but we never were able to pin it down, and finally there was an examination conducted, and the state of Washington was our representative on that examination, and during the course of that exam, the company finally folded. But, you know, they were employing all kinds of stratagems, putting California subdivisions into the company in exchange for big asset values, and it's hard to put them down. And, of course, when the companies are examined is when you often find out that they're insolvent.
Mm-hmm.
Denials per year do we run across on an average, or can you measure it by the year?
Well, I'd have to kind of guess just from a feeling. I think we probably have applications every year from 100 companies, and we probably turn down maybe 15 or 20 of those, maybe.
How many companies have literally gone belly up, or were fallen into this, if you will, safety net?
I think five companies, in the neighborhood of five or six companies.
In the past what?
Six years. I think our law was passed in 71, our guarantee fund law.
Well, how many bucks have been lost by Oregonians as a consequence, roughly?
The assessments in the Guarantee Association, I think, have amounted to about $750,000.
Well, that comes from the other insurance companies.
Yes, it would have been more.
Of course, I pass it along. I appreciate that.
It would have been more if the unearned premium had been covered, of course. Until this bill, the unearned premium has not been covered. And, of course, you are keeping in mind, too, that under this law, the state of Oregon becomes the final guarantor now instead of the companies themselves.
One final thing, Mr. Chairman.
One final question.
If if you'd care to kind of speak frank about it. Do you feel, or does the commissioner feel, that you have adequate staff and personnel and technology to do what you're supposed to do in this area? Or put it bluntly, ways and means keeps you screwed down. You can't hire the people you need, or don't not able to pay them enough salary to get the people you want.
Well, one is never satisfied completely in this kind of a situation, but we did ask for three more examiners, and when that request went before the Ways and Means Committee, it had been pared down to 1.5 examiners, and Mr. Bessonette made a very eloquent appeal before the Ways and Means Committee and got us one of those 1.5 positions back.
Are these all paid, these all user fees that come from the companies?
Yes, our examiners, of course, are covered.
There's no general fund money thrown into this?
The expenses of our examination are in our general fund appropriation. We charge back the expenses to the companies, and that becomes general fund revenue. It's
so
not
it's
a revolving fund. It's an
in-and-out
situation, but sometimes that isn't always clearly understood.
Thank you.
Chairman, I might add, I mean, probably 5 bankruptcies in 6 years is probably a pretty doggone good banking average, batting average.
Sounds good to me.
I think that's...
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Thank you. Anyone else wishing to appear on Senate Bill 63? If not, that concludes the hearing. Senate Bill 62. Frank, you want to turn right around and come right back up again?
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 62 started out as the Insurance Commissioner's Housekeeping Bill, and that was eagerly leaped upon by committee members in the Senate, and they added some substantive provisions to it, and after a circuitous course, it arrived in its present B-engrossed version. Sections 1 and 2 of the bill are strictly housekeeping. They make technical corrections in the insurance laws. Section 3 amends the uninsured motorist provision on reporting of accidents to conform with the Motor Vehicles Code of the 72-hour requirement for reporting. That was all that was in the bill. Oh, one other provision that opened Pandora's box. We were making what we thought was simply a technical correction of something omitted when this legislation was passed in 743-930, where companies, insurance companies, furnish the reasons for cancellation or non-renewal. They are granted immunity for the information that they give in those statements, but in our bill that was passed at the last session, we failed to put the non-renewal bit in there, and so that was being added in this housekeeping measure. When it came out of the Senate, they had changed what was formerly the requirement that companies furnish the reasons on request for cancellation and non-renewal. They had changed that to an automatic requirement, and so in this bill you'll find that in Section 7, insurance companies now will be required automatically to furnish the reasons for cancellation or non-renewal. Also, Section 6 was added in the Senate, simply, it's a more or less a technical thing, putting a requirement for a registered agent in for the Guarantee Association so that the lawyers can find them easier. And that's what's in this bill.
I see. Questions? Thank you very much, Frank.
I got a question. Why does the claim use true?
Tom, come back in. Tom Bessonette. Oh, there you are, Tom. You never leave. Do you have insurance, Tom?
Yes.
Life insurance, health insurance. Did you drink any of that coffee over there?
I have
I did today. I just inquiring.
The
coffee was excellent. I left my quarter in there, too, of Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I'm not even worried about that. I think your health is...
I'm more concerned about your health after tasting that coffee.
Well, I appreciate your concern about Tom Bessonette, who works for Oregon Mutual Insurance Company, for the record. That's a new way of introducing myself, I guess. On Senate Bill 62, this is the bill you may have read about in the early part of the session that Senator Vern Cook indicated that the insurance lobby was so diametrically opposed towards because of his sweet little amendment to require that we notify the insureds as to the reason we're not renewing their policy. Actually, there was no real strong opposition to it, but we did want to point out to the committee that this does increase the expenses of notification because many of the companies are going to the computer concept, and when we are going to non-renew, we will then have to jerk that file out of the computer and write a individual letter because we very seldomly cancel on a basis of mass cancellation, other than when we refuse to renew it with an agency completely. At that time, we can crank out a regular routine letter indicating we're no longer selling through that agent, which certainly has no detriment to the named insured. However, if we're canceling or non-renewing on a basis of driving records or something, we'll have to write the individual letter, which costs about $4 per letter. And that'll increase our expenses. Otherwise, we have no objections to the bill.
Thank you, Tom. Questions?
Yeah.
Representative Karen, he wants to know why you can't put that on the computer also. Representative Karen.
Well, I'm sure that when they... I understand how that works because of the... It's pretty obvious when you read it, especially with the no recourse provision when you tell them that they're a fake and you don't want to insure them. And I guess you can now call them to say you're a fake and we're not going to... We're not going to renew you, so I understand that portion. It also says, delete health and credit life insurance from application of Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association. That's in the first sentence in the summary, and maybe Mr. Yeah, somebody else.
That summary, okay, because I didn't see that in my red bill.
Otherwise, it is simply from 24 to 72 hours, and non-renewal, and what, you identification of that person you have service on.
This is incorrect.
My dad was still alive for 37.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Frank, may I ask you a question, please? The original Senate Bill 62, as it came to committee before it was engrossed, did it delete the health and credit insurance, life insurance from application?
Yes, it did do that.
Yes.
And that is,
they just didn't correct the summary.
Well, no. It deleted it from the app. It deleted it from the exemption from the Guarantee Association, not from the application of the Guarantee Association. And in any event, after you go that 180 degrees, it didn't do anything. It's simply a technical correction because the language in Section 2, where it said credit health and credit life, those kinds of insurance are already included in life and health, referred to earlier on line 11 and 12. And in the original model bill, the language was just credit. And when this bill was enacted in Oregon, it was erroneously worded to say credit health and credit life. It should have been just credit insurance. Credit insurance is bad debt insurance. It's not health and life insurance.
All right. I was just curious about that. Was the second error I think you pointed at the committee in the summary phase in the bills, and there's been a number of errors in bill summaries this session. So I just want to be sure what the nature of that error.
It was an error when the bill first came out.
All right, fine. Thank you very much, Frank. Anyone else wishing to appear on Senate Bill 62? If not, that concludes the hearing. And we're now down to the work session. House Bill 2516 and 2519, members of the committee, we we had tabled. Those were bills dealing with discrimination and insurance. And Mr. Finley indicates to us that he has some additional information or new information that he'd like to present to at least a portion of the committee so that they could report to us in the event that we'd like to consider it. So I'm going to ask that we remove those two bills from the table, and I will then appoint a subcommittee to hear that additional information.
Herb's name, Markham, keeps looking out the window.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I was going to make the same motion on Friday. However, prior to voting on the affirmative for the motion to take the floor to the table,
who's going
to
be on this?
I don't want to lose that subcommittee because Brad and I have suffered a lot of
things throughout
the years, and we have no desire whatsoever to.
I heard indirectly, and not directly from Representative Fabish, but I heard indirectly that Representative Fabish might have an interest in that. I know, so he's looking intently out the window at this time.
I'll be willing to look into it.
He would be willing to do that, and Representative Klein has vast experience with insurance. I might ask him.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Unless there are any volunteers.
Providing Representative Morris will always be available for.
I see that we already have two no votes to pull the bill off the table.
We've got two over here.
I don't think I give it to you, Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I think that if there's any new information that needs to be presented, that it needs to be presented in form of convincing individuals who originally voted to table the measures and not to those who voted in favor of the measures in the first place. And so for my own part, I would suggest that perhaps one of those no votes should be on that committee.
Yeah. I take it you're saying that you were voting in
I voted for the bills.
You voted for the bills against the motion to table.
Mr. Chairman.
You're volunteering Representative Markham?
Mr. Chairman, considering the controversy here, I'd like to make a motion to reaffirmate the tabling motion.
Let me ask you this. Is there,
if there is such a word as reaffirmation.
Is there any sympathy to pull the bills off the table? 2516 and 2519. I won't vote for it.
Only if the Willamette Press can get at you.
Mr. Chairman, if you want, I can now make that motion for the
record. Let's do it for the record. Representative Cairns moves that House Bill 2516-2519 be taken from the table. Do we need to separate the question on the two bills? All right, fine. Clerk, call roll.
Representative Mercurius?
Aye.
Fabish?
Aye.
Cairns?
Aye.
Klein?
Aye.
Markham?
No.
Morris?
No.
Shaw?
No.
Cyan?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Motion passed.
But we have a board explanation, Mr. Chairman. I agree that there was new information to be heard, and I think it was only appropriate that information be heard by the committee, but I am not volunteering.
Well, I think on that basis, I'm going to stick by my original inclination and ask the Representative Fabish and Representative Klein hear that new information, if it's worthy to share with the committee, to share it with the committee so that we might consider further action on the two bills.
Mr. Chairman, I certainly would like to see Achilles represented on that committee, too.
I think it's important, too, Mr. Chairman.
I do, too. I agree.
That would be two or no votes.
I think I heard a distinct disclaimer in his vote explanation.
I think vote is this true.
House Bill 3169, appoint the licensing board administrator.
It's been at least 6 hours. Oh, that's a good
This is a bill that transfers appointing authority of administrators of licensing boards in the Department of Commerce from the boards themselves to the Director of Commerce and the
3169.
The proposed amendment that you have in front of you, the effect of this is to make the, to understand the way that state civil service works, it would make the appointing authority for the subordinate employees, the secretaries, other employees, also the director of commerce. And the sole reason for the proposed amendment is in the state merit system, there's bumping rights. If your position gets abolished, the employee has seniority rights with other employees of the same appointing authority. So if technically the appointing authority is the director of commerce, any employee who gets bumped can have seniority rights within the department in other licensing boards. If the appointing authority is the board, there's probably not any other slot that person could fill. So the effect of this amendment would be merely to allow an employee of a licensing board whose position is abolished to have bumping rights within the Department of Commerce.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ryan.
I'll move it.
Representative Wagner moves the proposed amendment to House Bill 3169, dated May 16, 1977. Discussion on the motion.
Question.
Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Achilles.
Aye.
Babish.
Aye.
Kearns.
Aye.
Klein.
Aye.
Markham.
Aye.
Morris.
Is this on the amendment?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes.
Shaw.
Aye.
Byan.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. Motion passes. Now, before you, amended House Bill 3169.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative, was it Fabish or Vine? Or Marka?
Sir, may I ask the committee administrator to give us a, for instance, let's suppose that somebody here in the building board, something happens to them, or we abolish the position. Now, is that the position? Is that what this bill is aimed at?
No, well, it's what the amendment was aimed at. What the bill itself says is that is the builder's board on here? Yeah, okay. Instead of the members of the builder's board interviewing and hiring the executive director or administrator, whatever they call them, the builder's board, the administrative officer, the director of commerce would hire that person. After consultation with the builder's board.
And that just reverses the position.
Right. So that the administrative officers who work in the Department of Commerce would be working with the board, but be hired and fired, disciplined by the director that's in the board.
This, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This bill, if I remember right, came about because we ran into an instance where we thought there was maybe a breakdown in the way the system worked, and maybe the administrator
of the licensing board wasn't functioning as well as he could have if he would have had a little more free rein,
I think.
Good bill.
Mr. Chairman,
I might add. Are you sure?
Well, I was just going to move it so far.
Well, before you do, I just might add also that it's been my experience in three sessions that occasionally persons acting or directors acting for the various licensing boards felt that they couldn't freely, or in fact were directed that they couldn't really testify before a legislative committee. Because if they did, their job would be jeopardized. And I don't think that that's correct either, especially when we're out attempting to seek information as to the nature of how those particular boards function in relationship with the people that they're supposed to serve. Now, Representative Vine.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 3169 to the floor with the Duke, as amended with Duke's recommendation.
Is
Representative Vine moves House Bill 3169 as amended to the floor with the DuPass recommendation. Discussion. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Achilles.
Aye.
Faubush.
Aye.
Kearns.
Aye.
Klein.
Aye.
Markham.
Aye.
Morris.
Aye.
Shaw.
Aye.
Cyan.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. Motion passes. Unanimous consent calendar, huh? Sounds like. Did we ever get the amendments yet to Gary Wilhelm's bill, 2353?
Yes.
The computer is
just arrived from the print shop.
Wonderful.
The machine broke down, but they got them to us.
Those are the amendments. Holy cow, this is a one-page bill.
It was full of both sides. So
put an attorney to work by the hour, Mr. Chairman.
Sure, you have any idea,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Here is Mr. Wilhelm,
Mr. Chairman.
What was his comment?
Gail had dealt from Legislative Council. The drafter of these amendments is here. Essentially, to refresh your memory, the original bill said if the license period for your profession is July 1 to July 1 and you take the test in May, they have to prorate your fee. And this caused a big fiscal impact to the agencies. So the alternative was to change the July 1 date and just have any license good for 1 year from date of issuance, or 2 years, or whatever the period is. And so what council had to do was go through every agency that issues licenses and amend their law to specify anniversary date rather than July 1 or August 1 or whatever.
Grandma. 64-page bill.
Is this every license fee in the state covers?
It's every occupation.
If
you have to come up, I think it's every occupational or professional license.
Come on up, Gil.
And traditionally, have they those licenses been given on an annual basis with a cutoff?
Most of them are.
Most of them are.
Mm-hmm. We use the list of agencies developed by the Interim Committee on Labor and Commerce when they were going through their sunset proposals.
Would you identify yourself, please?
Gil Riddell, Deputy Legislative Counsel. And we used that list that was developed then. So there might be there may be licenses issued that would affect certain occupations, but we were using the confined to the 42 or so agencies that were identified by the Interim Committee for purposes of sunset legislation.
Another question?
Yes, go ahead.
What type of administrative changes or are we dealing with? Are we dealing with 42 separate agencies that collect licensing fees, or do those come into any central place? Who handles the mechanism now, and what kind of changes, if any, are we going to get from this?
Well, I wouldn't know about the mechanics. I could tell you that we went through the list and found that there had to be amendments to affect the agencies we identified. All the agencies listed except for six or seven, they had date certain.
You don't know
they had
the
identified in the statute a date certain when the renewal would have to be, when the renewal fees would have to be filed for the renewal of license. If the person entered the system in mid-year, they'd have to pay the full amount, and then when the year ended, the cycle ended, they'd have to pay the full amount to renew.
Yeah, I guess what I'm getting at is whether or not this is going to be an administrative headache for some people having to keep track of each individual in their licensing period, where before they just everybody had to re-up on a given date.
Representative Faubush, the communication that we've gotten is that the health division, which issues a lot of these kind of licenses, and you should have a letter in your packet. The Health Division feels that it would be a burden. The Department of Commerce, which issues the majority of the others, does not feel that it would be an administrative burden.
Pardon me, if I may.
Yes,
take time to go through this thing right up by Morganson, the assistant manager, fiscal services section, health division, certainly says it's going to become more costly and burdensome.
Yes, the health division.
We've managed to figure out how to do it in license plates, haven't we? Isn't that done around the clock? Every month? And they do it off a computer. I don't know why these guys can't do it.
They don't do it on trailer licenses.
Mr. Basin, why should you come in?
I don't know.
I
don't
like it.
They're saying
it's
40
years.
The other question I had for staff was, do we have included in this, say a person pays a fee in January and quits his profession in June, is the remainder rebated under the proposed amendments?
No, there's no provision for
that. No provision for a rebate.
We got him.
For a rebate. Okay.
We got
Could
him.
Be in a lawyer after 3 months after.
Well, I think he's great.
You're going to issue him a license.
See, the other question you asked, Craig, Tony can answer the one as far as mechanics in the Department of Commerce. And I believe the question was the burden that it might impose upon the Department of Commerce.
We can handle it because we have some semi-automated license issuing equipment, so that we will each month simply run a disk, find out who needs to get a notice to renew before the end of the following month. And then that those documents will go out, they will come back in. I do wish to bring the committee up on one item. As we looked over the bill, it technically says that if you got your license the 14th of October of 76, your renewal date is the 14th of October of 77. We propose by administrative rule, and I understand that Mr. Rydell has not told us it's against the rules. We propose by administrative rule to say that if you get your license during the month of October of, say, 1977, that your expiration date will be the last day of October of 1978, so that we've got one day a month that's target. It makes our machine work a little bit easier. And it means that nobody is penalized. You might get as much as 12 months and 29 days for your first year's fee. But I wanted to advise the committee that that is our plan administratively if this bill is adopted.
According to the fiscal impact was substantial under the pro rata bill that was originally introduced.
Yes, sir.
This bill, except for startup, wouldn't have any fiscal impact, would it?
That is correct. We would lose a little bit on startup, but we can live with that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Kennedy.
How much is a little bit? Yeah, you're now biting people, say, in the 11th, 10th, 9th, 8th, 7th month, all the way down to the month before the July 1. You bite them for the whole year, and then you bite them 1 month to 11 months later for another whole year. How much is a little? How much are you going to lose?
You have an idea, Ernie, on the exact amount?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't have an exact idea, but there will be a $5,000 to $10,000 one-time revenue loss, probably.
Spread out to,
spread out to how many of the licenses covered by this bill? How many of the total? You're saying $5,000 to $10,000 for the entire bill, or just for the ones that you're speaking to?
Just for the ones in the Department of Commerce.
Okay, and how many of the Department of Commerce is represented in this bill? What percentage of the licenses given here?
Roughly half of them.
So the whole thing might cost as much as somewhere between $10,000 and $20,000.
I can't speak for the health division. I don't know if they have all of their licenses mechanized. It'd be a
further question.
It'd be a 1/24th loss of whatever the income is on an annual basis. If you're looking at 1 month and not knowing whether you're applying the 1st or the 30th, so you average it out as half a month.
Also depends on the size of the license.
Got my metal computer working here.
That's semi-automated.
Yeah.
That's what they meant.
By
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I move the amendments.
Representative Morris moves the amendments dated 5/11/77 by Legislative Council. Discussion?
That's an act of faith.
Just one question. I didn't catch whether Representative Wilhelm is aware of what we're putting into his vehicle.
He is and approves.
He doesn't. It's too bad.
After you do whatever you're going to do on these amendments, there are two other proposed amendments that we can talk about.
Mr. Chairman.
Joe.
I suggest statutory authority to make it clear that, they could do that by rule.
All right. We may add that. All right. On the amendments then that you all have in hand, 511-77, further discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Achilles?
Aye.
Fabusch?
Aye.
Ken?
Aye.
Klein?
Aye.
Markham?
Aye.
Morris?
Aye.
Shaw?
Aye.
Cyan?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Motion passes.
In your packet, you should have another proposed amendment, a new section 58.
58, that's got to be a record.
No,
58?
Yeah.
Are you looking for another bill?
This is the Department of Commerce requested amendment. Essentially, what it
which
bill? To the people who are currently licensed to a license under the old July 1 date.
No, it's
because although in the future they will have people coming due every month, anybody who was licensed previously, they're all going to be up July 1. So what they suggest to do by this new section 58 is over the next year assign each of the old licensees a new renewal date and prorate the fee so that in 2 years all of their licensees will be coming up during the course of the year. And this only applies to those licenses issued by Department of Commerce agencies.
Representative Klein. If you've got these people all coming up on a date certain as is, and we're not addressing the problem of a new person getting into a licensing fee and being charged for a full year for only 3 months operation, administratively, wouldn't it be best just to leave them on there so you just catch all these people at once?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we issue about 95,000 such licenses annually in the Department of Commerce. Just by statutory accident, we do about 39,000 of those July 1. We're running in a tremendous peak and valley situation. The last legislature amended several of these licensing laws by putting in language that said that the department was authorized to give people new renewal dates and prorate their fees. That language is all being removed by this bill, and that's all right. But we are actively in the planning process now to take each of these groups. If this bill hadn't come, we would have taken some groups that are July 1 and moved them to October, others to December 1, and even out the workload. All we are asking with this amendment is allow us between now and June 30 next year to do that. And let's say that we're moving somebody from July 1 to October 1, we would only charge them, we would charge them a 15-month fee on July 1, in effect, or we would charge them a 9-month fee. But or a 12-month fee, depending on how we rolled it. It would, in effect, prorate the fee, but it would then array the big mass of these folks, 95,000 licenses, more or less uniformly around the year. Then each other person would come up, 12-month license, and we would have no problem.
Just one other small question, Kearney. Are you telling me, then, that what you have in mind is not... For example, if you're licensing the watchmakers, you're not proposing to spread the watchmakers out over the year if they're all on one date. What you're proposing is to have the watchmakers in 1 month and the builders in another and so forth. Is that it?
Watchmakers, yes. Yeah. Landscape architects, yes. Builders are already 12 months.
Okay.
But yes, you are correct, Representative Klein.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Move the amendments.
Representative Klein moves the amendments, proposed amendments, House Bill 2353, Department of Commerce. Discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Securius?
Aye.
Fabusch?
Aye.
Ken?
Aye.
Klein?
Aye.
Markham?
Aye.
Morris?
Aye.
Shaw?
Aye.
Diane?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. Motion passes. Do we have the amendments that Phil suggested? Giving statutory authority.
They haven't been written. I'd have to write them.
Mr. Chairman,
all right. Would that have to go into each section, or can we have a catch-all section there?
I think you could.
Good. I hope so.
Me too.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Would you like a motion as to the concept of the included here with a proviso that you review those if you intend to move this bill today?
I don't intend to move the bill today.
Oh, okay.
Because I understand we're going to get a fiscal impact statement, and I think it would be wise that we look at that before we make a determination whether or not it ought to go to Ways and Means.
So you want to wait and see what that item is?
So Gil would have time to prepare that. Do we have another set of amendments?
Yes. The unsigned thing I just handed out is a proposal of the real estate division, and for the four types of occupations that they regulate, instead of the anniversary date, they would prefer the prorated fee concept that's in the original bill, and suggest that in the appropriate places in the bill that regulates those four professions, that this kind of language be inserted.
Mr. Hillier, why should you be treated any differently than anybody else?
May I suggest, Representative Grinnell, in part it's because they've been ahead of everybody else and they've gone to a motor vehicles type of licensing before anybody else did.
We have, however, several technical problems as far as the way that the bill is now drafted. We have a number of satellite licenses. And by that I mean you have branch licenses being offered to brokers. And if the bill is technically passed as it's now written, you have a branch license that would extend beyond the failure to renew the broker's license. You have some 3,400 operators, solicitors, adjusters, and managers of credit agencies who in essence would have a license that does not then relate to the agent's license. So if the collection agency or the credit agency ceases to exist, still these licenses would, at least for the expiration date, appear to be valid. We have branch escrow offices, which again would extend beyond the principal office. And so in talking to the sponsor, Representative Wilhelms, this morning, he seemed to imply that what he was really trying to get to was to make sure that there was a full measured offered every licensee. As we looked at these technical problems, we felt as it applied to the real estate division that it would be much better that we take the initial fee and prorate that initial fee. And then they go on the cycle that they're on. Now, the real estate division for its principal licensing, which are the 18,561 now real estate licenses, those people are on a birth date, the last month of the birth date month, or the birth month, I guess would be to put it, on a 24-month or biennial process. So we already are spread as far as the year is concerned, or the biennium is concerned from that standpoint. Once again, our difficulty, however, is tying these satellite licenses to each other so that we don't have a license that's actually without foundation. After talking to Representative Wilhelms, we came up with the wording that is being suggested as far as the two segments. We have some annual and some biennial licenses. And I could relate to the committee, and I'm embarrassed that the time was too compressed to actually put the entire amendment before you, but there are four areas of our chapters in which, if this language is inserted, we would be able to be treated in the way we feel that we can administer better. We ran some cost studies as far as the way the bill is now drafted. We are on a batch mode process at the end of the month. If we were to go to a single day within the month, it would cost some $30,000 more in data processing costs. if the amendment which Courtney has just suggested goes through, obviously that is not a problem that we'd have. With all of this thought in mind, we would appreciate the consideration of this committee and going to the prorating of the initial entry license fee and then going on, in essence, the program of annual or biannual dates as we're now applying them. That has the advantage of tying the licenses together that I've complained as being a problem. If that is not acceptable to the committee, we have a second series of motions because there's some technical problems in the amendments that relate really to the real estate division. There are some internal inconsistencies, and unfortunately there are two other segments of our law that have not been brought into the amendments, so that we would end, if these amendments were adopted, in having now an inconsistency between other provisions of the law. I would prefer, obviously, the first. And if a policy decision can be rendered by the committee, I will immediately draft the amendment with Deanne's cooperation to submit it.
There's no objection from members of the committee. Why don't we allow Ralph to do that in conjunction with the other amendments suggested by Mr. Bateson? You're objecting?
No. I have a question. I'm not sure I understand, Ralph, what the problem is. You've got to see someone gets a business license and he is on this license and he is on that license. They're all expired now. What you're saying is that you get one in 1 month and then 6 months later you get another one, 1 week expired and the other one will run.
Yes.
Is that right?
For instance, on page 53 of the amendments, you delete the language as to the expiration date of branch office licenses, so that if Representative Shaw is a real estate broker and his birthday is in May, for instance, the end of May is his expiration date as far as his license is concerned. But if in September he wishes to open a branch license, the expiration date of that branch license would in essence be the end of September. And if he did not renew on the biennium at the end of May, he would have a license for a branch office that extended beyond his own original license. And that just doesn't fit. It's a license without an anchor, if I can use that terminology.
Giving you license, that's clear.
Yes.
Any other questions? Is there any objection to having all of those amendments included together? Gil, if you could have that for us, maybe by... I suppose we're not going to get around to this thing before Friday if we're going to have a fiscal impact statement. Do you have any idea, Dee, when we're looking for that?
We might have it by Wednesday, but I'm...
All right. Well, we'll put it on both Wednesday and Friday's work session. Hopefully we have the amendments and the fiscal impact statement by that time. Get some idea. House Bill 2299.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, move that up. Can I table this bill?
Make the motion.
I move the House Bill 2299 be tabled.
Well, while everyone's looking it up, I'll take Representative Morris's motion. He moves that House Bill 2299 be tabled.
Coming.
Clerk, call the roll.
Representative McCurious?
Aye.
Farbush? Karens?
No.
Well.
Klein? Markham?
Nope.
Morris?
Aye.
Shaw?
Aye.
Bryan?
No.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Motion fails.
Change your vote, Mark.
Mayor, before you, the bill, and you have some amendments. Were those amendments adopted? I don't believe they were.
No, I don't think they were.
All right.
What was the count on that, Mr. Chairman?
I don't know. All I counted was the I votes, and there weren't enough.
There were the count on the current boat, the one in the book? Four.
Mr. Chairman, I move that any woman try once more. We have two members not present.
No, we only have one not present.
There we had Martin voted. Oh, did Martin vote? Well, we got one.
No law says they can't move twice, is it?
Guess not.
Representative Morris moves that House Bill 2299 be tabled. Clerk call roll.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Can I?
Sure can. You can take a look at it.
Thank you.
Would you like to ask a question?
I don't know. Let me look at it.
It's non-debatable, but I imagine you could make an inquiry. And
well, we are looking. Well, let's look.
What's the motion? The table? The table.
Proposed amendment.
Thank you.
Say Representative Crest.
He just voted out the turkey. Just voted to keep it here. What are you calling a turkey for, Mark? Give him a chance to read it. Go through the democratic process. Wouldn't want to deny Wayne a.
Greatest discussions on a non-debatable motion from this committee than anything I've ever seen in my
life. No, I'm not your committee, Jimmy.
Well, our committee chairman's not a tyrant, unlike the elections committee.
Have you ever heard of a benevolent dictator?
Let's vote.
I'll call for the question, Mr. Chairman.
If Representative Morris would be willing to withdraw his motion for 1 minute, I think we might be able to resolve the question after I ask the question of staff.
Well, why don't you go ahead and just ask your question?
What do you do that,
Mark?
Start everybody.
Democrats can have to track again.
The question is,
ruin your back.
It's been a while since we've seen this bill. I think the bill the hearing on the bill was correctly reported that a great deal of what this bill accomplishes is now being accomplished by administrative bill.
You take them off.
Yes, the insurance commissioner has adopted an administrative rule requiring that a disclosure statement be given, essentially when the policy is delivered. And so if there is a disclosure statement, the differences are it doesn't contain everything that's in here, and this says that it must be delivered earlier than the insurance commissioner's rule requires.
Can I ask staff a question?
You may ask a question.
No
debate.
What is this question?
Is it true that this bill, you just said part of it, this bill requires that the disclosure statement be presented early so that the consumer can compare two disclosure statements and decide which is the better of two insurances? Would that be the intent of this bill?
No, I'm going to ask the question.
Well, I said, Mr. Chairman, call the question, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the question in a non-debatable motion. Is it possible for other members of the committee who might want to ask one of us who are on the subcommittee if we can respond to a question, not in debate, but if staff is available for questions or not, other members
of the committee? I can fairly defer that question to the members of the subcommittee.
Yeah. I want to.
So defer, yeah.
One of the members of the subcommittee wants to ask a question now.
No, I want to respond to one of those other questions.
All right, respond and I'll ask the question.
In response to the question, the differences are that the amendments would expand the scope of the disclosure. It would first do that. Second, it would make a very substantial or material change in that a consumer could go from each of the five or six insurance companies in the state who offer this kind of co-insurance and collect these disclosures without making any binding agreement. And third, we put in the statute with a proviso included that if any of it becomes null due to a change in the federal level, then the insurance commissioner can simply delete that portion from the disclosure. That is the essence of the bill as opposed to the rule. In response to the question from Representative Klein, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Klein, as I recall, posed that question.
Yes,
it is. Yes. The insurance commissioner laid out, I believe it was insurance commissioner, laid out a very good reason why we couldn't have the early disclosure. Was it that we couldn't get the cost from the agent that had run through the company? Do you remember what it was?
There were...
He laid out a very logical reason. I've forgotten what it is.
It wasn't so much the cost as the exclusion. They wouldn't be able to tell you that you were...
That's it.
Because you had a history of heart disease and your...
Prior medical condition... Wall says impossible prior medical conditions indeterminable.
Yeah.
I have a question.
I could ask staff another question. I could ask Representative Morris one.
Okay. Do you have another question, Representative Brown?
Is it, Representative Morris, would it be impossible for the disclosure statements to include a disclaimer? In regards to prior medical history?
I don't know.
Court call, or is this to table?
This motion to table.
Representative Achilles.
Aye.
Faubus.
Debate.
No.
Cairns.
No.
Klein.
Aye.
Markham.
Aye.
Morris.
Aye.
Shaw.
Aye.
Ryan.
No.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye.
Thank you.
Prior to start of it, I think that that ought to be considered today. Why don't we get that filled out if we'd like? I understand there is some interest, some people in the audience.
There is, definitely the audience.
I don't know, that sounds like a great bill.
Mr. Chairman, I
won't amend the last one.
I thought I might wake him up in the backyard.
My biggest concern with Dennis is, having been married to a dentist's daughter, was he made a couple comments a couple times about it, but they have to.
I'm
going to
get
My biggest concern was the habit of a dentist, when he filled two cavities, he would nick two more teeth so that the next time you came back, he would, you know, it's...
I just like to have a task force set up to look at his former father-in-law, I guess, might actually just point out his regard, or lack of regard.
He was president, I think, of the Senate Association.
I mean,